Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. Coming up on this week's show, we've got Oscar-winning actress Helen Hunt on going behind the camera for the first time for Then She Found Me. German filmmaker Dennis Gansel discusses his chilling European hit, The Wave. And The Guardian's Zan Brooks will be joining me to discuss some of the week's best new releases, including Ben Stiller's controversial new comedy, Tropic Thunder. But first, let's take a look at Linha de Passe, the latest film from Brazilian director Walter Salles, the acclaimed force behind The Motorcycle Diaries and Central Station. Following hot on the heels of recent Brazilian successes such as Elite Squad and City of Men, this film follows the lives of four very different brothers and the choices they face growing up in a dead-end São Paulo neighbourhood. It's a departure from sun-drenched favela chic Brazilian cinema, depicting São Paulo as a grim and rain-sodden metropolis. I caught up with Salles and his co-director Daniela Thomas in sunnier times at the Cannes Film Festival, and they began by explaining how the name of their film, Linha de Passe, comes from a popular Brazilian football game.
Four guys get a soccer ball, football, and they play with it. And if the ball falls, the guy loses. So yeah. They try to keep the ball in their feet.
It's really about brotherhood and not letting the ball fall within a family. You know, as this is the story of four brothers who try to somehow reinvent themselves in a really tough society. You know, we wanted to find a title in Portuguese that transmitted the necessity not to let the ball fall. So it really works really well in Portuguese, and we're sorry that it doesn't work well anywhere else in the world.
You know? It's amazing, but we have keepy uppy, we call it in English, but that's on your own sometimes, and then you can play with two. You can't play with four, but keepy uppy is a terrible name for a film.
They're childish. Yes. Linha de Passe is serious.
It's a serious film about the state of the world today. You can't calling it keepy uppy, but anyway,
maybe
I think
you would have to help us.
I've been thinking it as well. I start with soccer because I mean, I love football and I love cinema, and it seems that in Brazil at the moment, obviously football is a big love, but cinema is becoming more and more important to the whole continent of South America, and particularly this Cannes. We've already had Fernando starting the festival off. I've seen the Trapero film, which you are the producer of. Why is this new wave of Latin American films breaking over our shores?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think that our reality is ever-changing and is extremely rich. It's a fantastic canvas on which to paint on. If you're a filmmaker, you know, you just grab what reality is offering, and you kind of transfer that to the screen. The difficulty is that it changes so fast that sometimes what you're actually telling, inspired by their reality, may not be, you know, what's going on when the film will come out.
So you think São Paulo has changed even from the one that I'm seeing on the screen?
Every day. But one thing that I have a theory that I just made up here, but I'm thinking that Argentina and Brazil are only 20 years away from dictatorship, a very long dictatorship, and I think this is the first generation of free people, you know, who have been thinking freely without the throngs of the censorship, military pressure. So this is a new generation that's come to life. We are like 30, 40, 50.
And you're not 50.
Yes. I'll be in March next year. Anyway, but we're coming to life, you know, in a free society after many years of dictatorship. And I think that probably has something to do with that, you know. So it's the first generation of filmmakers who are in free countries.
Well, it's a pleasure to see it. I mean, it really is, I think, the most exciting place in the world at the moment. I keep going there on holiday, I have to say, but I can't change my mind. But I mean, it's because of the cinema is attracting that. It is helping the rest of the world understand your continent, isn't it?
Well, I think that cinema is by far the most potent manner to understand what a culture is all about. I mean, I learned so much about Iran, for instance, by watching Abbas Kiarostami's films, or Japan by watching Ozu, Mizoguchi, Kurosawa. And what would be of England without Ken Loach? Yeah. You know, I mean, he's a master, and one that really helps you to understand the conflict within the society. And you know, we try to do a similar thing with our limits, within our limits, in Brazil, is to give an idea of where we are at a specific time. and generate a kind of an understanding of our country. We have to do this looking at the country itself and then offering those films to Brazilians first, and eventually they will reverberate elsewhere.
It seems to me about finding a narrative, finding a story, finding a way through the mass of humanity that there is, particularly in São Paulo, and that you've done it as best you can with your four boys. It's a great way in to finding some story, I mean, in this city.
Yeah, it's such a rich canvas, again, that we thought that four different characters would give a more complex understanding of the possibilities there. I mean, four young kids trying to reinvent themselves in the midst of a very chaotic, arid city, and yet I think the desire not to stay in the little hole that society has granted you is very universal. Yeah. I mean, it is something that pertains to these kids' situation, but you could also say that on the outskirts of London or Paris, you know,
Tokyo,
you would find, or Tokyo, you would find the same kind of need. Yeah. And this has to do also with, I think, with globalization, with the fact that the economy has kind of became the same in so many different places, including, I would say, China. If I watch the films by Jia Jiankui, there's something in the characters that he portrays that I can empathize with.
Walter Salles, Daniela Thomas, thank you very much. Mucho obrigado.
It's our pleasure.
Did I say that right?
Yes, absolutely, man.
Walter Salles and Daniela Thomas there. And Línea de Passe is released this Friday, the 19th of September, all across the UK. And you can watch myself and Walter, handsome and suave as ever, in an in-depth interview as the latest in my new TV series, In the Director's Chair, available only on guardian.co.uk. But time now for our regular and revered review slot. I'm joined in the film pod by The Guardian's own roving film critic, Zan Brooks. Welcome, Zan. This week, we'll be discussing Línea de Passe, Tropic Thunder, and Unrelated. So let's start with Línea de Passe. And as we heard from the directors just now, it's the story of four brothers making their way on the mean, busy, crowded streets of São Paulo. Zan, are you a fan of Walter Salles?
Yeah, and I think I'm particularly a fan of this Walter Salles.
Excellent.
I had slight problems with his kind of Hollywood remakes, and also I had slight problems with Motorcycle Diaries, which I know you loved.
I'm a big fan, yeah.
I loved it. This is sort of going back to his sort of social realist Brazilian roots, a real kind of labour of love film. He's co-directed it with Daniela Thomas, who I think he started his career working with. And yeah, I thought this was great.
Well, I think this one, you know, it is a rather, I haven't really seen a film like this before. As you say, it's social realist, and I think, as we heard from Walter Salles in the show, the influence of Ken Loach is quite big. And I found that extraordinary to find that that such things can influence a story about Brazil. Because I think in Brazilian cinema, we are used to sort of seeing now the City of God, the kind of hyperkinetic, saturated colours, the music. This hasn't got all of that. This is almost
even
anti those.
It treads the same terrain and touches on a lot of the same issues. It's interesting you say that, because I remember when this previewed in Cannes, some of the criticisms were that they had seen it all before, that this was favela chic, that this was kind of going through the same old neighbourhood and showing us that it's really hard if you're a slum kid in Brazil. And yet I thought that it had such kind of warmth and humanity and integrity that didn't matter to me. And I thought this was done in a new way. This wasn't a tabloid scare story, and it wasn't an incredibly kind of preachy, earnest, dull film. This felt like it had a heart and a soul, and was kind of living among these people.
I'm with you. I thought it was ignored at Cannes until its actress won the Best Actress.
Yeah,
and
she's not even an actress. She's a sort of non-professional who making her first film, and is absolutely superb as the sort of mother, you know, presiding over this dysfunctional but generally well-meaning,
very
brood.
Unshowy performance. Actually,
beautiful performance.
And in fact, it's the sort of second time that, because Walter Salles made, I think it's Fernanda Montenegro, who won the Best Actress at Berlin for her portrayal in Central Station as the elderly woman who's taken the cut. And so those themes are there, clearly.
He's got a way with middle-aged women, hasn't he, Salles?
Yes, he's a very charming man. That's Línea de Passe, a big hit with Zan and myself. Next up, let's take a look at Tropic Thunder, the story of Ben Stiller, Jack Black and Robert Downey Jr. trying to make a film in the jungles of Vietnam.
You're my brother.
You're my brother.
I'm your brother. I'm sorry, can we cut?
No, no, we're still rolling.
What's going on for real? My butt is hurting.
You know what it is?
Damien, I think it's the line.
So now we're in rewrites, right?
Where are you going?
Let's rewrite it.
X injection, can't cry. That's what's going down.
I'll do it.
You know what, Kirk? I'm ready to do the scene.
Now it's time to flip the script.
You be until Chinese New Year, wait for my man to cry.
So, Zan, this little take and skit and spoof on the Vietnam movie, did it work for you?
It did. I thought it was very funny. There was a point, probably about sort of 10, 15 minutes in, where I thought this is going to be one of the funniest films I've ever seen. It starts with a great series of trailers from other films, sort of spoof trailers. And it just seemed to know exactly what it's doing. It's really kind of going for it. It's taking some risks. Then it kind of loses its way a bit. I mean, the characters in this film get lost in the jungle making this sort of platoon-style, Apocalypse Now-style film.
So is it kind of Hearts of Darkness documentary?
It's Hearts of Darkness played out. It's the story of the making of a bad Vietnam film with a lot of kind of insecure, egomaniacal actors in it. They get lost in the jungle, and the film kind of gets lost in the jungle as well and starts sort of going in circles and getting progressively noisier and more kind of panicked and throwing more things at the screen, hoping to kind of get out of this impasse. But it's sort of 60%. It's brilliant.
Right, which were the bits you'd like? Because, I mean, some of the things have attracted quite a bit of criticism, including Robert Downey Jr.'s blacking up to play.
Yeah, where do we begin? Where do we begin
star?
With...
does he get away with it?
I think he kind of does. I guess the obvious defence position for the filmmakers is to say, we are not satirising black Americans, we are satirising actors. Robert Downey Jr. plays a sort of a Russell Crowe-style Australian thespian who gets so kind of into his role that he plays his part in blackface and remains in character in this frankly very unconvincing portrait of a sort of 1960s army chef from San Antonio who's a former saucier. So he does that. The other great controversy, of course, is Ben Stiller's character, who in a blatant attempt to get an Oscar makes a film called Simple Jack, which is a film that looks very, very like Sean Penn's film I Am Sam, in which he plays a kind of yokel imbecile who talks to the animals
or
on the farm.
As Robert Downey Jr. so politically correctly puts it, a retard.
But he goes the full retard. And obviously that's got people incensed. But again, you could see this either way. It possibly is poking fun at people with learning difficulties, but I think it's more likely poking fun at pretentious actors interpreting people with learning difficulties as a means to further their career.
Zan, I have to say that I thought this film was rubbish.
Really?
I really didn't work for me at all. I thought the jokes fell. I didn't think it was smart. I didn't think it was funny. I thought it was a waste of money. I kept looking at explosions and all that Vietnam stuff. I thought, well, this violence I don't really understand because it's not funny, rather in the way that Pineapple Express last week kind of was a very funny stoner comedy for a while and then sort of resorted to kind of shootout violence. I just thought that I don't really think these bullets are funny when people are actually being killed, as there are a whole kind of raft of kind of Asian looking actors, extras, I don't know, being kind of wiped out. I the joke was completely lost on me, and I sat there stony faced thinking, I really want to enjoy this. I thought the trailers at the beginning were quite funny, and then the whole joke went, the whole kind of even the kind of comic logic of the thing, the fact that they were making a movie being filmed by a movie.
Yeah, they didn't know what to do with it in the end. I really like the cast. I thought Jack Black had nothing to do and he was kind of wasted.
He was a big, fat, smelly man in trunks.
But I really like Robert Downey Jr.'s performance.
Yeah.
And I like Stiller. I do tend to like Stiller. There's that kind of suppressed rage about him and frustration that I kind of like. It's a film from within the Hollywood goldfish bowl. So it's kind of not really biting the hand that feeds it. It's kind of gently kind of nibbling.
This
on
was
it.
My problem. It's sort of let's try and kind of spoof those Vietnam movies. And I think
he kind of loves them.
But it didn't really do it, did it? It didn't kind of go all out and kind of
It didn't do it, but it had all the kind of the symbolism of them. And it had so many kind of little references, the sort of the weird flapping arm crucifixion scene from Platoon that Stiller gets to do twice, that does kind of show the ridiculousness of those semiotics that we've all been kind of had imprinted on our brains over the last 20 odd years.
Yeah, with utmost seriousness.
Yeah, and I do think that it kind of debunked a lot of that, and I found it a lot of fun. I agree with you that it didn't know what to do with itself in the end. It didn't push itself to any kind of proper conclusion, and it did lose its way quite badly at times, but I still found it a lot of fun.
Let's move on to a British offering, Zan. It's a film called Unrelated, the first film by a director called Joanna Hogg, and it examines what happens when a family of quite posh people go on holiday to Tuscany.
Where
whatever sex is like at the beginning after 12 years is going to change, I think. Well, people I've talked to anyway, I'm not... I mean, long-term relationships are not easy. They're a challenge.
What about kids?
Well, we don't have them.
Any reason? Wait, does he not want them or something? Is he one of those people who's just not interested in...
No.
How does that make you feel? Did you ever want them?
This is Samantha. I think you know.
You managed to drug.
Sorry.
Hanging around. Pay them or
something. I said, yeah. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Between the two of you.
What, and our sex life?
And Joanna Hogg's Unrelated. It carried off a prize at last year's London Film Festival. Is that where you saw it first?
Yes, it is. And I enjoyed it a lot. I think it's weirdly a very unusual film from Britain, which is a strange thing to say about a kind of middle-class drama.
What do you mean unusual?
Well, I think this is a sort of film that the French often do.
Yeah.
It's a film about the British bourgeoisie. And it's a film about the tensions at work within that little social framework. It's a real hothouse drama. And I think that British directors weirdly tend to run scared from that.
They either do
very posh people having a comedy.
So the Merchant Ivory type things.
Or a Merchant Ivory thing, or a Richard Curtis sort of take on it. Or they do go the Guy Ritchie route and do, you know, the gangsters. Or they do period.
Yeah.
So they don't really make films in of this kind of ilk. This is a sort of film that you could imagine Claude Chabrol doing, or Eric Rohmer or somebody like that. It's a small scale. It's a minor key little film. It's very delicate. It's shot on digital video, so it's very low budget. It's nicely acted. Nothing much happens, but it's superbly atmospheric.
I thought I wasn't going to be interested in the lives of these people. I thought they were terribly annoying, just a bunch of kids that I thought I hadn't seen since school, thank God, who people had taught to tie cricket jumpers around their necks.
You went to a very different school.
I got rid of them.
I was at the Guy Ritchie School of Hard Knocks.
Was ya? Well, I thought, the last time I saw these people was in Tuscany. I've never been back since those kind of English men who wear those boatery type hats to go walking and wear chinos all the time. I mean, just, I thought, horrible people.
Absolutely.
However, the style of the filming, the kind of, as you say, the Roma type middle class babble, the kind of wind and the kind of establishing shots of the countryside drew me into the mystery and actually made the intensity of what was happening, the little thing that was happening, the little drama, so intense of the sort of breakdown of this 40-year-old pre-menopausal, kind of on the cusp of menopausal woman played by...
Catherine Worth,
an actress new to me, who I thought was superb and really got to, you know, got to this great canvas to perform on.
I think... in the end, perhaps, when things are explained, when the revelations come, we find out exactly why this woman has come here on her own and left her husband behind, blah, 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 it loses a little bit of its power. It has such a kind of fine line
in terms of its
temperature.
A nuanced mood piece.
That when you actually try and explain it, it's a nuanced mood piece, and it works in terms of atmosphere and incidental details.
You're the second person that said to me, oh, it's sort of a shame that we had to reveal what the kind of country house mystery was, the whodunit aspect of it. Not that there is a sort of whodunit, but I actually really thought that worked. I thought the kind of technique led up to this revelation so that scene had great power when we found out what he did or what it was all about. So it didn't diminish it for me.
It did for me because I think that it's a mood piece and you're actually kind of living those little moments and that is where it's at its strongest. When it imposes a sort of structure on things and has a payoff, then weirdly it sort of evaporates.
You're saying that kind of setup looks a bit kind of contrived.
And schematic,
And schematic.
Then it's suddenly a conventional film again.
Well, whatever one feels, it is nice in this terrible weather that we have here in the UK to be reminded that you can have a little slice of sunshine in your life. Go and see Unrelated by Joanna Hogg. Zan Brooks, thanks as ever for joining me in the film pod. And if you want to catch up with Zan's views and reviews, go to guardian.co.uk/film. I'm Jason Solomons, and you're listening to the Observer Film Weekly podcast. Next up, we've got Oscar-winning actress Helen Hunt on her directorial debut, Then She Found Me. Based on the novel by Eleanor Lippman, this bittersweet rom-com covers themes of pregnancy, love, faith and motherhood. It sees Helen Hunt's character involved in a bizarre love triangle with Matthew Broderick and a smouldering Colin Firth.
This is a first date, and if you're not done with him who you're married to, I mean, if you're not... If you two aren't done, it's fine. It's more than fine. Just tell me. I'm not ready
but
anyway.
I am
then.
Done with him.
Yeah, but it's okay if
but
you're
I
not.
Am.
It's okay
but
if you're
I
not.
Am.
How do I know?
You're going to have to trust me.
You're kidding me.
That doesn't feel like a first date. Not to me.
You wait until we try and say goodnight.
I met up with Helen Hunt and I began by asking her if she found her first experience behind the cameras a daunting one.
Sure, you'd have to be insane not to be daunted by the job, but as you begin to fall in love with the story you're telling, that's sort of the counterbalance to how afraid you are that you'll do a poor job at it.
Did you always know you were going to direct this at some point?
I used to say I would only direct something if I loved the story enough or if I felt uniquely qualified to tell the story. I don't know where I got that. I think I made it up, but it turned out to be true. I did decide to direct this because by the end of the writing process, I thought it would actually be more difficult to explain to a director what I wanted than to do it myself.
Was it the novel that you fell in love with first?
I liked the novel so much, and it was a totally unique relationship, this grown woman who's found by her birth mother. And then as I tried to figure out what it needed to become a film, there were elements that I brought in, like her desire for a baby, this very painful, hopefully funny love triangle. Those were elements that I added in order to take what was perfect on the page and put it on the screen.
How long did it take you, this process? Because was it more involved than you ever thought it might be?
Yeah, I mean, I read the novel 10 years ago, so it was a decade of work. And then 2 seconds to shoot the movie after all that time.
And then editing, how was that as a process? Because that's, you know, the directors really come into their own there. What
right.
was it, and that's probably what you've never done before.
Someone very smart said to me, the movie is never as good as the dailies and never as bad as the first cut. And boy, I thought the dailies were fantastic. In the very first cut of the movie, I was despairing. And then slowly you start to realize that as a director you have these tools. You know, there were pieces of the love story that weren't quite working, and I had this wonderful musician, David Mansfield, who came in and wrote a theme for Matthews and my character that then replayed later, that then a sort of warped version happens when they have a disastrous romantic encounter toward the end. So you do have other people and other bells and whistles to add to the movie to tell the story
yeah.
they want to tell.
Who knew? And I always think that the hardest thing to do with these things is get the tone right.
Right.
And that's, and it's still, I mean, yours is, and you've gone for what is very difficult, a tone, mm-hmm. a kind of romantic comedy, but a kind of bitterness about life as well as like tragic edge to it.
Right.
How did you juggle all those aspects as well and make sure that you ended up with a film that was neither mawkish nor over sentimental nor too sad?
Right. Really and truly, honestly, I think it's, for me, from my ear, this is the kind of movie I know how to make. I'm not sure I know how to make a movie that has no humor or that is purely a fall-down funny
yeah.
film. I like to go see those movies, but my sensibility, my favorite films, my life is amusing and heartbreaking alternately. So I wasn't worried about the tone. The tone made sense.
What are those favorite films? I was trying to kind of see
right.
the influences. And obviously, you know, we know your own work, Say Mad About You and As Good As It Gets,
right.
and those kind of things. But what are the ones that kind of informed your
well,
artistic life?
All of Jim Brooks's movies walk that line of being, you know, they disarm you by getting you to laugh, and then when you're open and laughing, they break your heart. So certainly his movies, I think, show up in this movie because I'm such a big fan of his. Preston Sturges' movies probably are in this. Truly, Madly, Deeply, Anthony Minghella's first film, I watched that quite a few times before I made this movie.
Mm-hmm.
The tone of that seemed right, and he didn't have very much money to make the movie. He talks in the DVD about how you very quickly learn what's important and what isn't. Is the light matching perfectly? No. Does it matter? No, because these actors are acting their heart out in a story that they love.
It was obviously this wonderful part for you in this film as well. Did you have to have this part in order to get financing? Because you know,
no.
you're in the hunt, so you have to be in it.
I didn't have to. I thought at first I wouldn't be in it. I thought it was much smarter and that I'd enjoy directing more if I wasn't in it. And then over time I realized it was a very good part and I didn't want to let that go. And Second of all, logistically, I couldn't afford to not put an actress in the part that would do whatever I said and work 24 hours a day.
How are you?
So
are you difficult?
I was wonderful.
I mean, because you're in it a lot as well. I mean, as first-time directors kind of give themselves, I mean, not that always the lead part.
No, I'm the center of the movie. Yeah,
and you're doing it in a car as well. You're doing a lot of in-car acting, which I was thinking you need a real director to kind of sort of say, to see that.
Yeah.
So how do you get out and sort of say, oh, I like that shot?
Well, lucky that there's a monitor you can look at, but I didn't have enough time to really look at it, so I don't know. I did my best.
Yeah. When you won your Oscar, that's when you kind of get, do you think, well, I've got the clout now, people will give me, I can make a movie, I can be a director now?
No, I mean, it's a fun night. It's a really fun night. What it actually does for your career, I don't know.
I don't know, but I think for some it does, but Best Actress in particular, I don't really know what it does for people.
Yeah, so it's smart not to count on it.
Yeah. Have you found it, in a way, I sometimes think, it's harder afterwards. I mean, for Halle Berry, it got harder for...
it's hard to find a good story, you know.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. So when you do, you grab it and are grateful for it.
Right, and then you have to make it yourself.
Right.
Because it almost seems that you've sort of worked less
I had a baby. I have a life at home that means a lot to me, so it takes more to get me out the door than
right.
I would have before.
Oh, you have a baby. So the themes of pregnancy and adoption and miscarriage that come into this film, was that, and you said you personally put those in.
I did, and my wish for a baby, I'm sure, informed a lot of the writing.
Mm-hmm. And then you had one.
Yeah.
So and that was that the time where was it something you were wishing for, or was it difficult to?
I wanted a daughter very much and was very lucky that she came.
And you got a daughter.
Yeah.
How old is she?
She's 4.
And what's her name?
McKenna Lay.
McKenna Lay.
Mm-hmm.
After
it's Hawaiian. It means the many flowers of heaven.
There you go. Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful story. And she came before, so you'd made the film.
She was 2 when I made the film.
Right, but while you were writing, she was...
Yes.
She was being wished for.
She was.
Well, congratulations on your daughter as well, and on your film, Then She Found Me, which is really lovely.
Thank you.
Film. But there were moments where I did, you know, not wishing to say anything bad about it, but there were moments where I thought, oh no, this is not going to work at all. And then it kind of pulls itself back, and then it goes into different directions, and I think that's a very difficult thing to handle, especially as the first time, and the pacing and the changing of it. So,
well, thank you.
It was a nice surprise indeed.
Thanks.
Helen Hunt there, and Then She Found Me is released this Friday, the 19th of September, at selected cinemas across the UK. And again, do go to guardian.co.uk to watch highlights of Helen and myself in conversation. Films exploring the madness of crowds, revolutionary politics and dangerously charismatic leaders are staple fare for German cinema these days. After films on the Red Army faction and the Nazi era, German filmmaker Denis Ganzel's latest work is Die Welle, or The Wave. This film looks at the true story of a high school teacher who introduced his students to the idea of a dictatorship by setting one up in the classroom. The film shows how the teacher quickly became a leader and how the pupils soon turned into his terrifying army. I started out by asking Dennis about his reactions on reading the true story of this frightening experiment for the first time.
The first thing which pops up into your mind is there a chance that this kind of experiment can happen again? And the second question, of course, is what would be my part in the experiment? Would I be in the resistance or would I... be a character like Tim, like a bodyguard? And that's so I read it when I was like 12 and I never forgot it. So it's really the question, could it happen again, is really, and not only in Germany, also here, if it's Scotland or France or wherever, it's really, and the teacher says it can happen again anytime, anywhere. And that's an interesting question.
So the book is an American book, The Wave, very popular in German schools. Every school children in Germany reads this. It's not so popular here in England, I have to say. So for you as a young German filmmaker to get to make this book must be amazing, because it must have been so... Every filmmaker in Germany must have read this book.
Yes, absolutely. And but we wrote a concept because everybody wanted to do a movie about the real experiment. It's set in 67 and in San Francisco. And I was working with my co-writer, Peter Torwart, and our interest was more like, can it happen again right now? Because we all know so much about fascism, and I did a film about fascism and about seduction during the Nazi era, so I was more interested in today. what would happen if I would be a teacher or I would be a student. So our approach was, okay, we want to tell a cautionary tale, but it's set nowadays. And that was something which struck a chord with Sony TV, and they were the right owner, and they said, okay, go with it.
So I have to ask you, Dennis, do you think that this could happen today? Why is this the time for a film about the re-rise of a fascist tendency? It seems that your students in the film almost have a need for it, and that's what fascism did last time, certainly in Germany. It fulfilled a gap in society.
Absolutely. When I was young, I always felt a big gap. I always felt there is a need for a big and huge idea. I always remember the stories of my teachers. They were in the 68 movement. They had something really to fight for, and the whole generation was one movement. And when I grew up in the 80s and 90s, I always felt there's the punkers, there's this group, but there's no unity. And during our researches, speaking with a lot of students in German schools, we discovered that the need for a big idea is even stronger nowadays. So we felt that this could be a good theme today. And the tricky thing about it, it's not about fascism at all. Actually, it's about belonging to a group, not to be an outsider, and to create something very strong within the group. And that's something everybody can relate to.
Well, what interests me in your film, and I don't know about the source novel, but you do it in a week. You do it so quickly, which seems to me that it means that you have to read the film metaphorically, as you say, like a fable or a cautionary tale, because it happens, you know, Monday to Saturday, suddenly.
Oh, actually, in the real experiment, it was not only 6 days, it was 5 days. So we kept to the original experiment. Everybody says, oh, it's so quick. It was that quick, yeah. It was on day one, he actually started the experiment. On day five, he ended the experiment. And at the end of this experiment, they had like 800 students with the wave and three high schools. And we said, okay, we will make it like one high school and 150 students. That's enough.
So in terms of the experiment and in terms of the teacher in your school, the monster he created was like Frankenstein. It was too dangerous even in 5 days.
Absolutely. He told us, look, Dennis, I enjoyed it being a leader. I enjoyed it being admired all the time. And he created some kind of mini Stasi, mini Gestapo. So he handed out like membership cards, and for this membership card they had a red X on the flip side. He said, those people with a red X, come to me after the lesson and tell me if anybody is against the wave or if there's any discussion. And after 1 hour, 20 people came to him, and often best friends cheated on the other one. Or students came, you know, my father, he told me something about the wave in the evening during dinner, and he talked about the wave in a bad way, and he had like to stop it after 2 days. And I was like, okay, we will stop it because it's getting too big, yeah.
So there's something in human nature that needs to cling to this unity.
Unfortunately, I think, yes. There's nothing bad about group mechanisms and about group things, as you see right now with the championship in Austria and Switzerland. It's fantastic, but it can easily change and you can manipulate. Mm-hmm. And that's something to talk about.
Director Dennis Ganzel there, and Die Welle, or The Wave, is out in selected cinemas from this Friday. And that's all we've got time for this week. A big thank you to all of my guests, to Walter Salles and Daniela Thomas, to Helen Hunt, and of course to Dennis Ganzel and The Guardian's own Zan Brooks. I'll be back next week, but for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer this week, Tom Wolfenden, it's goodbye.